I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Rob Krett. He is director of the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks very much. Happy to be here.
Well, this is a nice week because this Thursday would have been Georgia O'Keeffe's 125th birthday, if people could live that long, and there's a lot of celebrations around the anniversary of her birth this week at the museum and in town.
Well, we have a lot of things planned, and we're really thrilled to participate with a number of events all week. You know, one of the things that I'd love to let all the listeners know is that on the 15th, actually, the museum will be open free all day.
And that's the actual birthday.
That's the actual birthday, yeah. So it's just, you know, one way in which I think the O'Keeffe Museum can be a more active part of the community, do something like this free day to help to celebrate the 125th.
So what's the show that's in the museum now?
It's really an interesting exhibition because it combines not just O'Keeffe's paintings, her drawings, some photography, but it also includes some of her camping gear. And so it's a little bit different, I think, for some of our visitors to see some of O'Keeffe's camping gear, but it's perhaps one of the lesser known facts about the O'Keeffe Museum. We actually not only own several hundred O'Keeffe paintings, 1,100 O'Keeffe's in total, but we also have thousands and thousands of her objects of her personal property, including her tent and sleeping bag and some of the camping gear. And so we decided to install this exhibition in a way that it depicts some of the areas in which O'Keeffe would travel to and would paint. But we thought we would bring some of it to life by also showing the public some of her personal material as well.
Which, to our modern Gore-Tex and nylon eyes, looks somewhat antiquated.
Absolutely. It also really shows how hardy she was as an individual.
Yeah.
To camp at the Black Place, for instance. It wasn't exactly around the corner, and so it took quite an effort to get there. And we have a wonderful archive and library as well. And with the archive, we have a number of photos that actually shows her in Maria Chabot camping, and so it was a wonderful way in which we could depict what the tent may have looked like, and so visitors can not only see works that she created out in the wilderness, but they can also see how she lived as well.
Now, there's some new books on O'Keeffe that have come out recently. Georgia O'Keeffe in New Mexico, Architecture, Katsinam, and the Land is one of them. And the other is Georgia O'Keeffe and Her Houses, Ghost Ranch and Abiquiu. These are both books in which the museum has had a major role.
Sure. Actually, the first that you mentioned, it's a catalog for an exhibition that recently opened in Montclair, New Jersey. And one of the things that I've always admired about the O'Keeffe Museum is that we might have small galleries, but a lot of ambition. The organization has been really successful over the years in organizing nationally touring exhibitions, even internationally touring exhibitions. We just finished a European tour where we had a retrospective exhibition of O'Keeffe's work that traveled last year to Rome, Munich, and Helsinki. And it just wrapped up in September, actually, in Helsinki. And on the heels of that exhibition closing, the staff, and I do have to really commend the staff at the O'Keeffe Museum. It's a great group of people, and they're very hardworking and dedicated. And a number of them left wrapping up the exhibition in Helsinki and returned to the States and installed the exhibition at Montclair, New Jersey. And this particular exhibition has been in the making for a number of years. And as with most museum exhibitions, usually there's a 3 to 5 year time period in which to do the research and for the exhibition. And with this exhibition, we took a little bit more time, however. And the original development of the exhibition included 16 of O'Keeffe's painting of Katsina images. And the original plan was to pair them with Katsina dolls. And we have a wonderful curator at the museum named Carolyn Kastner, and Carolyn has done a lot of work over the years with the Native American community and particularly Native American artists. And one of the things that she suggested we do is to go a little slower here, and that we be respectful of our Pueblo neighbors, and that in developing the exhibition, we actually expanded much further than just the Katsina to take into consideration some of the early years that O'Keeffe was here, 29, 30, 31, And during those years, her first experiences here in New Mexico, she not only painted these Katsina images, but she also depicted the architecture and a number of landscape pieces as well. So the exhibition goes much further than the original idea. And we also have engaged a number of Native American artists that actually contributed to the catalog. Dan Naminga and Ramona Sequestewa both had participated by writing essays that are part of the catalog. And I, again, just want to really compliment Carolyn for involving members of the Native American community in the process. And so the exhibition is now on view at Montclair, New Jersey, and will be there through the end of the year, and then it'll travel to Denver to go to the Denver Art Museum, and it'll be there through the spring, and then it will travel to Santa Fe, to the O'Keeffe Museum. And each installation's a little bit different. Every museum made its own decisions about whether it would show the Katsina dolls or not, and at the O'Keeffe Museum, we decided not to do that out of respect for our neighbors.
Why is it not respectful to show them?
Well, they're religious figures, and so I think that there is a lot of time and attention paid toward those Hopi traditions that are very personal and private, and we are the O'Keeffe Museum, and O'Keeffe depicted these images, and so I feel very comfortable in showing what O'Keeffe had created, but in working together with Carolyn and a number of other scholars, we decided that we would not show the actual doll in the galleries.
What was O'Keeffe's relationship like with her Native American friends and neighbors?
Well, you know, I think that's a good question. I think things that I've read, and I'm certainly not as expert as some others are. I've just been here for 2 or 3 years now. But one of the things that I've read is that O'Keeffe attended a lot of the ceremonies. She was certainly very active and involved in the community of Abiquiu, where she had a home. So I think that she was very respectful and certainly appreciated the Native American culture.
So does the show end in Santa Fe?
No, actually, there's one more venue. It'll travel to Phoenix, and it'll be at the Heard Museum in the fall of 2013. So, again, this is an example, I think, of how the O'Keeffe Museum has accomplished an awful lot in its first 15 years, and we are celebrating our 15th anniversary this year as a museum. And as museums go, 15 years old is pretty young, but I do think that the museum's accomplished a lot with its scholarly catalogs, its books, its exhibitions, and you also referenced the book about the houses.
Yeah.
And it's a wonderful project that Barbara Lines and Agapita Lopez really moved forward. And one of the things that really attracted me as a candidate when I interviewed for the job here at the O'Keeffe Museum was what I like to call its constellation of assets. And it's very unusual. Single artist museums aren't very common. There's
right.
A handful around the country, the Dalí Museum in Florida, the Rockwell Museum in western Massachusetts, and a few others, but there are very few of them. There are a whole other group of historic artist homes that exist, but it's very unusual for a fine art museum to have a permanent collection of work of an artist as well as their home and studio. And the O'Keeffe Museum not only owns one historic property, but we actually have two historic properties. The second is O'Keeffe's house at Ghost Ranch. And those two are really the subject of the book, and I think it's a wonderful way that these historic properties have been brought to life, and we've involved a number of scholars with the project. A local architect, Beverly Spears, she wrote an essay about Adobe architecture, and so it helps to put some of it in perspective, but it also documents the rich resources that we have in terms of these houses.
I think there's something that happens for what you might call educated secular people, which is that they don't tend to believe in saints and make pilgrimages to churches, but they really do for somebody like O'Keeffe. And she becomes larger than life. And I mean, I was talking to somebody who said that there are people who've brought pillows into the museum and kneeled on them. And her houses become shrines. And it's a funny relationship. Mm. You must observe that as director of the museum.
You know, there are times that our galleries are modest. We have about 5,000 square feet of gallery space. And so a couple times during the year when we change galleries out, we actually close the museum galleries. And try as we might with PR and putting things on our website. Some people don't read those things, and they make that pilgrimage, and they come out to Santa Fe. And I've seen people weep on the sidewalk when they can't get into the museum. And so I think you're right. There is something certainly iconic about O'Keeffe and the life that she's led. And we're uniquely situated to be able to demonstrate and to show the public aspects of her life, that not only the work that she created, but the environment in which she created them. And I have to say that that's been one of the one of my first experiences in going to Ghost Ranch, was certainly experiencing that place, the sort of silence that permeates, but also recognizing in the landscape a number of images that O'Keeffe depicted. And I think that it's a great opportunity for people, when they do visit the O'Keeffe Museum, to not only see the galleries, but then to also have a chance to see how the artist lived, and then to also see some of the views that she's depicted in her artwork. And so, in a way, historic buildings can certainly be a challenge, but I think what we can do is make some of the artwork come to life in ways that it wouldn't otherwise.
I think they also give opportunity. I mean, I was looking through this book and looking at the pictures of them, and it does make you think about how you yourself are living, and how somebody so prolific with such a richly complex life can live in such apparently extreme minimalism.
Exactly. Well, I think that's important to note. And one of the things that we're also looking at doing a little bit new next season, the house in Abiquiu is open seasonally, really March through November. And we don't have aspirations of turning the Abiquiu Home and Studio into Graceland. And so we will always be very respectful of the village of Abiquiu. And the preservation of the home and studio is really very important. But one of the things that we're excited about next season, we'll offer a behind-the-scenes tour. And one of the things that's not well-known about the home and studio in Abiquiu is that there's a bomb shelter. And so...
Really? She built a bomb shelter?
She built a bomb shelter. And when you think about it, in the 50s and 60s, living pretty close to Los Alamos, it's not so unusual, perhaps, but it's not really been seen before by the public. And we thought that it's not just an aspect of O'Keeffe's life, but it's really an aspect of life in the 50s and 60s, and certainly part of life here in New Mexico as well. So the bomb shelter will be available for people to see. And then,
What's it like in the bomb shelter?
Well, it's pretty barren. It's cinder block walls. It has two bunk beds that fold out from the wall. For a number of years, I understand that she used to store her dog food in the bomb shelter.
I was going to say, are there 65-year-old canned goods in there?
Well, there is a Geiger counter, and so it really does. I think it'll be interesting for people to have a chance to see that. It's a little different, very unusual, but people will also be able to see the Salita, where O'Keeffe had actually matted and framed a lot of her work. And so right now it's used as a storage area, but we're going to clean that up and open it up. And so I think it'll be a wonderful way for people to see, even if they've been to the Home and Studio in Abiquiu before, it'll be a great way for them to see different aspects of the building as well.
It's always fun to go up there too. I remember so distinctly the first time I went to Abiquiu, and I was just visiting New Mexico. I'd never been out here before, and I'd loved O'Keeffe's work and thought, wow, what crazy, wild imagination in terms of the colors. And then you come out here and you realize that they're completely realistic.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and what I have really come to appreciate as well is, as different as Santa Fe might be in terms of its landscape, it's very different in Abiquiu, especially with the Chama River Valley. It's lush green hues. And then that's still different, again, from Ghost Ranch. And so I think it's really remarkable to see the diversity of the place. And I think that's one thing that O'Keeffe, I think, has really been known for, is her ability to be able to capture that sense of place.
We're talking to Rob Krett, director of the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum. Now, what's it like to head? I mean, you were saying there are very few one-artist museums. Here you are heading up a one-artist museum, and, I mean, you have to keep changing it up. You can't just take your collection, put it on the wall, and go home.
Yeah, I think that certainly is a challenge, but I think that one of the things that we have going for us is that our collection actually represents her entire artistic output. And O'Keefe, as many of your listeners probably know, began to create work in the teens, and she kept painting and doing work all the way into the 80s. And so for this particular artist, for the museum to be able to show different aspects of that artist's life, I think is something that is very unique to us. We also do some changing exhibitions from time to time, and they're modest in scale again, but I think that the museum has done a wonderful job of not just looking at O'Keefe and her work, but also placing her in context of American modernism. And we also, getting back to the constellation of assets, one of the other things that the O'Keefe Museum has that's really very unique is a research center. And the research center has a number of scholars in residence every year, and they'll do work in a variety of subject areas, primarily art history, but we also have scholars that can be accepted that are doing work with architecture, with music, with literature, a whole variety of topics. And so placing O'Keefe's work in the context of American modernism, it gives us a little bit more flexibility in terms of the kinds of exhibitions and programs that we do. And of course, traveling exhibitions around the world is another challenge for us, but it's a way that we can not only bring O'Keefe's work to, say, audiences in Europe, but we can also bring a little bit of Santa Fe and New Mexico as well.
I would imagine that some people really appreciate the contextualization of O'Keefe in terms of American modernism, and other people just want to see nothing but O'Keefe's.
You're right.
The pilgrims.
Exactly. And you know, I think that, you know, her work is certainly recognizable. It's very approachable. I think that there are a number of points of access to understand her work. And one of the other things I think that we can do through her artwork is, in a lot of ways, we can talk about the history of the 20th century in America, because her work spanned practically the whole century. And you know, I think that it's really interesting to also to be able to compare her to other artists. I just had the opportunity to visit the Frida Kahlo Museum in Mexico City, and the parallels obviously are numerous, and I think it's interesting to take a look at what else is going on in different parts of the world in the 30s and the 40s. And of course, O'Keefe was traveling back and forth between New York and Santa Fe, and every once in a while when I feel a little pressure at traveling today, I'm always just reminded of how difficult it must have been in the 30s and 40s for someone to do that.
Yeah, really. I know every time your airplane is late, you think, this is nothing compared to that. How did the museum start? Was there a collection of work that needed a home?
Well, we're very fortunate to have the generosity of the Burnett Foundation. And the Burnett Foundation is Anne and John Marion's family foundation. And the story that I was told, and I understand what happened in the early to mid-90s, Anne had a collection of a number of O'Keefe paintings. And she was thinking about what she wanted to do with that collection of paintings, and was contemplating gifting them to a museum, wasn't really sure what she wanted to do, and her good friend Stanley Marcus had suggested to Anne that if she wanted to do something with those paintings, that if she wanted to do it right, that she would have to do it herself and to start her own museum. And I've just been totally impressed with the generosity of the Marians, and what Anne has done in particular for the George O'Keefe Museum is incredible. And I think that her generosity has done a lot to not only create the institution, but to also help to make these first 15 years as successful as they have been.
So when an artist is that well known already, and the museum is being founded after her death, and the work is really expensive, I mean, how do you acquire that much work? And are you still in the process of acquiring O'Keefe works?
Well, a variety of ways work can be acquired. The generosity of individuals or organizations like the Burnett Foundation is one. Work has been purchased over the years and donated to the museum. And yes, it is very expensive. But one of the things I think that was really very important that happened with the O'Keefe Museum was the Georgia O'Keefe Foundation, which was formed in 1986 when O'Keefe passed away, had as its purpose to distribute the remainder of the assets of her estate. And so there were certainly a number of organizations that received work into their permanent collection. There were a number of family members that were involved with the foundation that also received work. But in 2006, the foundation was scheduled to close. And so it was really a watershed event that occurred in 2006 when the board of the O'Keeffe Museum and the board of the O'Keeffe Foundation agreed to transfer the remainder of the assets of the O'Keeffe Foundation to the George O'Keeffe Museum. And that was a watershed event that occurred where hundreds of works came into the museum's collection at that time, as well as the ownership and responsibility of the home and studio in Abiquiu.
So we are now, it's the beginning of the week of George O'Keeffe's birthday. It's her birth week, as we say. Her birthday is Thursday, would have been 125 years old this Thursday, the 15th of November, and there's a bunch of things that are happening. We're going to be talking in just a few minutes to Roxana Robinson, who is the premier George O'Keeffe biographer, and there's a photography competition where people can submit flower pictures by November 15th. Is that right?
Well, that's one of the deadlines. People can go on our website, theokeefemuseum.org, and they can learn a little bit more about the competition. But there are several different age groups, and there are several different deadlines that I believe go into December.
Oh, okay.
And so they can learn a little bit about that, but we thought that was just one of the ways in which we could celebrate O'Keeffe's birthday, as well as a jazz concert on the 17th. And I hope that people have an opportunity to, again, take a look at the website to learn a little bit more about the jazz concert. It'll actually be with multi-Grammy nominee singer-pianist Karen Ellison, and that'll be hosted at the La Posada Resort. And tickets, if people are interested in tickets, they can get tickets through ticketsantafe.org.
Excellent.
And I think that
And there will be birthday cake.
There will be
a bubbly birthday toast.
Well, you know,
lots of good stuff.
Lots of good stuff. And I think that it's really just, again, our effort to be celebratory with this 125th and to really continue to move the museum to be much more of an active part of the community of Santa Fe. And we have a lot of public programs and exhibitions, things going on all the time. But I think that the birthday celebration just gives us a moment to sort of mark the calendar. And you know, as I said, opening the museum for free on the 15th, I think, is just another gesture that we can offer to the community to make them a part of our celebration.
Do you have as many local people coming to the museum as you do people from out of town?
No, we don't. I guess is the short answer to that. And the O'Keeffe Museum, we have about 150,000 to 160,000 people that come to the museum every year. And 85% of them aren't just from out of town, they're from out of state.
Right.
And so there's a huge dependence in a way of these out-of-town visitors, and we certainly want to continue to have tourists and people coming from out of town to come to the O'Keeffe. Certainly, I mean, you can read a lot about the economic impact of cultural tourism, and, you know, these travelers stay in hotels and restaurants, and we're certainly glad that we've got that economic impact, but one of my goals as the director of the organization is to try to find a little bit more balance so that we're doing more things for our community. And we really look at the community not just as Santa Fe, but really the state of New Mexico and the region. And so over time, I hope that we're going to be able to have a little bit more balance and move that 15% of participation up much higher than what it is right now.
Rob Krett is director of the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum. They can be found on the web at okeefemuseum.org. Thank you so much for being with us.
Great. Thank you.
I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Roxana Robinson. She's the author of 8 books, including the biography Georgia O'Keeffe, A Life. And this Thursday, the 15th of November, she will be giving a lecture titled O'Keeffe, Reading the Work as the Life, at the St. Francis Auditorium at the New Mexico Museum of Art, and it's part of the Georgia O'Keeffe 125th birthday celebration. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hello, it's nice to be here.
So, Georgia O'Keeffe, especially from our perspective here in New Mexico, in Santa Fe, is often seen, I think, as an artist who's associated with nature and land and place. But she was doing very important work that a lot of people don't know about before she ever got here. She was one of the innovators in abstract art. Tell us about that.
Well, it's a very interesting question because she's most popularly known now, as you say, as somebody who did the flower paintings, who did the beautiful landscapes in Santa Fe. But she was also an early American modernist and part of a movement that started at the very beginning of the 20th century and was a movement in the art world that really responded to what was happening in Europe and the great early stirrings of abstraction. And so O'Keeffe was really interested in what was happening in Europe. She was in New York around 1908. She saw Alfred Stieglitz's galleries where he showed Matisse and Picasso and Rodin at a very early moment. So she broke loose from purely naturalistic representation very early on in her career. And so she, for the rest of her life, really, she swung back and forth between realism and abstraction in a way that was extremely fruitful. And her abstract work hasn't really been considered until recently as a separate body, and it's a very impressive one when you look at the whole corpus of those images. It's extraordinarily beautiful and very powerful.
I often wonder whether she, as one of the very first American abstractionists, hasn't really been given credit due as a lot of women innovators are not given credit due.
Well, it's true. She wasn't one of the earliest abstract painters. Most of her work, her very early work, well, no, that's not true. 1915, 1916, she was doing purely abstract pastels, and they were ravishing charcoals and drawings, and they were ravishing and very innovative. And Stieglitz did recognize that, and she was shown early on, and she was perceived as an artist that had a unique place. But then once she did the flower paintings later and the bones, those became sort of her signature, and people stopped looking at the abstract work. One of the interesting things that she did was, and the reason she isn't put into particular circles, she was certainly part of the Stieglitz circle, stable of artists, but her work doesn't look like anyone else's, so it's hard to group her in with a well-known stable of artists. But one of the things that she did, which was so interesting and was completely unique to her, was to draw on the abstract nature of photography, which was moving in that direction in the teens. And she saw the work of Paul Strand, who made images from everyday objects, only made them into pure abstractions. It was very disconcerting and beautiful and extraordinarily innovative. And she used those techniques. She used magnification and cropping and vertiginous angles for her own work, but what he did was to strip the subject of emotion, and what she did was use it to infuse the subject with emotion. So her magnified flower pictures are part of a continuum with his magnified bowls, for example, which are shown in his photographs as something that's completely abstract. And they're wonderful, they're fascinating and beautiful, but you don't know what they are. O'Keeffe does the same thing using magnification and cropping with flowers, and you know exactly what the flowers are. So what she's doing is going for the essence of the subject and imbuing it with a tremendous sense of passion and emotion. So what she was doing was something that was right in the middle of the artistic flow and power that was taking place in America, but she used those things for her own purposes. So she doesn't seem to be part of another trend, but she was. She was part of these trends that were taking place aesthetically and intellectually, but she used them to create her very distinct and singular work.
It's interesting to talk about this because it brings up a lot of, I think, questions and interesting conversations, the kind that sometimes you have when you're in museums standing in front of paintings and photographs and things like that, of what's really the difference between real and abstract. Because, I mean, if you go in close enough, it becomes abstract. And the fact that I might recognize this as a flower, somebody else sees it as an abstract shape. There's not really a clear boundary.
It's a really good point, and it's very hard for us today to imagine what it was like for the public in 1921 to look at those shapes, or in 1915, because we now are used to this blurring between abstraction and realism. But in the late 19th century, when realism was really the tyrannical force in painting, you know, it was almost photographic. You had to put in every single detail. And then suddenly, as the century turned, people started using this semi-abstract brushstroke that became very loose, and images became blurred. And the public was very resentful at the beginning. Initially, critics were furious. Remember when Turner did his beautiful paintings of fog and the Thames, that one of the critics said, "This is like having a pot of paint thrown in your face."
Right.
So we have become much more sophisticated, and we recognize things now as semi-realist, which were, when they were first produced, looked like abstractions.
We're talking to author Roxana Robinson about Georgia O'Keeffe. Now let's talk about Georgia O'Keeffe's relationship with Alfred Stieglitz, who I guess kind of discovered her and showed her work and was older than she, but they were also really equals. What was that relationship like?
It's a really, really interesting relationship. And throughout the history of art, women painters have had a difficult time for lots of reasons. Critics sometimes don't respond to them, or dealers don't, or the public doesn't recognize them. In the case of O'Keeffe, she was definitely discovered by Stieglitz. He was a really powerful presence in the art world. He was not only a photographer who championed the cause of photography and really insisted that it be accepted as an art form. So he was a vocal presence in the art world, but he was also a dealer and showed new and innovative work. And he was 23 years older than she was, and he was married when they first met. And he was very vocal and talkative and handsome and charismatic. So he was a tremendous force. Students used to come in, and when he first met him, he didn't remember this, but when she was a student at the Art Students League, her friends said one day, "Let's go over and listen to Stieglitz," because he would just talk at his gallery. He'd come out and just talk about art and hold forth. So he was a tremendously powerful figure. Interestingly, he doesn't remember meeting her when she came into the gallery, but the way he thought that he met her was through her work, and a friend of hers sent him drawings that she had done, and he saw the drawings and was transfixed by the beauty and the forcefulness and the female quality of them, and he famously said, "At last, a woman on paper." So he met her first through her work, and then when they finally did meet in person, she was living outside New York then, they fell in love. But she also responded to, they wrote to each other for quite a while and wrote very powerful letters to each other. So they connected on many levels, and they were both artists, they were both very powerful, they were both innovative, and they sort of cleaved together. He left his wife, they married in 1924, and they stayed together for the rest of his life, but it was a fiery relationship, and he had an affair with another woman quite publicly, which was devastating to O'Keeffe, and she had a nervous breakdown as a result of that. But they did manage to stay together. They decided that they had a great deal of connection, and they stayed together. He died in 1946, and she stayed with him and took care of him, and although she left to go in the summers to Santa Fe, but she really stayed as his wife for the rest of his life and loved him. But he was a champion of hers in the art world and insisted that people take her seriously. And, for example, there was a show in Pennsylvania by a museum, and Stieglitz was asked to send works by his artists down there, but they told him, "We don't want any women in this show." And he said, "If you don't want any women, you can't have any of my artists. You only get my artists if you take O'Keeffe." So he took a very intransigent position on her work from the beginning. It was partly because he was in love with her. We have to acknowledge that. But it was also because she was a great, great painter. And I think without his incredibly powerful presence, she would not have received the kind of acclaim that she did. so it's a really interesting relationship, and I don't know of another one like it in the history of art. So she's definitely benefited from it, but on the emotional side, there were real drawbacks. She said at the end of her life, or closer to the end of her life, when there was a show of his work of photographs at the Metropolitan Museum, she said something like, you try to destroy each other. And it was a great comment to make. I mean, anyone who has a passionate relationship with anyone else understands what that means. And they did. And they also tried to invigorate and support and love each other and be the best partner that they could possibly be. So it was a very complicated, rich, interesting relationship.
A little while ago, we had Rob Krett on the air, who's the director of the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum, and we're talking about this whole phenomenon of people making pilgrimages to the O'Keeffe Museum and to the places where she lived, and treating her as as a kind of Lives of the Saints thing that happens with artists whom people admire. How has O'Keeffe, in your view, been not just a kind of icon, but a real positive role model for people?
I think one of the things that struck me, one of the key moments when I was writing the book, one of the things I learned about her, which resonated for me and maybe for a lot of women, when she was early, she was not a discovered artist. She was living in South Carolina and teaching, or maybe it was at University of Virginia summer school. Anyway, she got up early one morning. She said she wanted to go up to the top of a hillside and see the dawn come from it. And so that meant she had to climb this mountainside in the dark. And she said the grass was wet, and the whole time I was walking, and it was dark, the whole time I was walking, I was afraid of snakes. And I was so struck by that, the fact that she knew she was going to be afraid the entire time, but what she was going to find at the end of it was worth it. And it seemed to me that was a metaphor for her career, that she was always afraid of breaking ground. It's always frightening to be an artist and to risk making mistakes and failing. And as an artist, as a courageous artist, you always run the risk of failing. And so there was always that sense of fear, but always a sense in her that it was worth the risk. Taking the risk, it was always worth it, because there was that sunrise at the top of the mountain that you were focused on. So I think O'Keeffe, for a lot of women, seemed to live a kind of life that accepted the idea of risk, took on things that were too much for her. Sometimes she did fail, but she never stopped going. She went up through the dark and the wet grass and the snakes, and she made it to the top of the mountain for the dawn.
That's a wonderful, wonderful metaphor. I'm going to remember that, because it's not about being fearless. It's about having fear and just doing it.
Exactly, because no one's fearless, and it's great to understand that someone you admire is afraid and goes on anyway.
Now, she lived a very long life. She outlived Stieglitz by, what, another half century or so. Did her courage and creativity and innovation continue throughout her life?
Well, to a certain extent. She died in 1986, I think. And she had macular degeneration, so she was, after a certain point in the early 70s, I think, she had no direct vision. She only had peripheral vision. And, you know, people's powers ebb. So she certainly kept on producing things throughout her life, really, till very late in her life. I don't think she was as much of an innovator after, well, the 70s, maybe. But she had this tremendous outpouring of creativity, and most artists don't create many new things in their lives. There's usually one signature kind of work that they're known for. And O'Keeffe had a much longer arc than most artists. There are many things she's known for: the beautiful abstractions, the bones, the flowers, the red hills, the early watercolors. She really went through a huge range, the later cloud paintings. So I think there's a tremendous breadth that she accomplished. And she still was working in her late years, but not at the same level.
We're talking to Roxana Robinson, biographer of Georgia O'Keeffe, and I wondered what it's been like for you. I mean, this book came out over 20 years ago. The book is done. It's in print. and life goes on, have you found new material or new insights or new thoughts? Is her life a kind of ongoing set of questions for you?
She certainly is a presence in my life. The other books I've written are works of fiction, short story collections and novels. But art is a big presence I find in my writing life, and often the characters in my books are involved in art in some way. They're, one is an artist, one is an art historian, one is a photographer, partly because that's such an interesting world for me, and partly because it's a world that I know. Writers always have to create spaces for their characters to live in, and John Cheever once said he was so jealous of men who went to offices because he had no idea what they did in them, and he needed settings for his characters. But I used to work in the art world, and I really enjoy that kind of intellectual questioning, and I'm interested by the questions that art historians and that artists and photographers have. So that those are places that I use for my characters to live. I haven't gone on writing about O'Keeffe just because it's such a huge field and there's so much new information. I thought I would either go crazy trying to keep up with it or I would set it aside. So she's a huge presence in my life, in my intellectual and writing life, but I haven't tried to stay up at the top of the material, knowing the material, just because it's I know so many other scholars have gotten involved with it.
Right, right. Now, how did you start in the first place? How did you become her biographer? How did you get into that work?
Well, I was working in the art world and writing. I started out working at Sotheby's, and I was in the American Painting Department, and that was my field. We did 19th and 20th century American art. So I worked on those artists. We sold a lot of work by O'Keeffe, and I started writing about those artists, and I wrote about Arthur Dove and Marston Hartley and just became very interested in that group of artists. I met O'Keeffe. I met her agent, Doris Bree. So she was early on a subject that I was very interested in. And I went on elsewhere after Sotheby's and wrote more about that circle. And then after she died, I had already published another book, a novel, and a publisher knew I had written about art and asked if I would be interested in writing that book.
So you met O'Keeffe. What was she like, and what was it like for you meeting her?
I was already a groupie. I was already a tremendous admirer of her. I got a call from her agent, Doris Bree, asking if they could see a painting by O'Keeffe that we had at Sotheby's. So I went over to Miss Bree's apartment, and O'Keeffe was there, and it was a really interesting, sort of unsettling encounter, the way those things are when they're someone that you admire so enormously, you're sort of blinded by your own impression apart from the person themselves. And what struck me was, first of all, O'Keeffe was very short, which was a surprise, and she was wearing a house dress, if you remember, with a self belt, and she was wearing little black Chinese cotton slippers, and there were some lawyers in the room, and they were talking about the work. I forget what it was, why they were interested in it, but O'Keeffe was simply looking at the painting. She was paying no attention to anyone else talking. What they were talking about was serious and legal, and she was simply re-encountering the work, and it was as though she was looking at a child that she had not seen in years, and it was she simply stood and looked at the painting. It was one of those moments that you remember. There was a deep bond between her and the work.
Yeah. You are giving a lecture on this Thursday, the 15th of November, titled O'Keeffe, Reading the Work as the Life at St. Francis Auditorium. What does that mean? Tell us about what you're going to be talking about.
Well, while I was writing the biography, my editor and I decided that we would not use color images as illustrations, and we wouldn't use a lot of paintings because there are so many books that have color illustrations, and this is a biography. So I wasn't allowed to have in my book the pictures that I wrote about, and I wrote about a lot of her work because it's obviously so important. So this is kind of an illustration of my biography, and what I did was go through the body of her work as though it's a visual biography, autobiography done by her, and that's really the way I see these particular works. Like many artists, O'Keeffe sort of painted her own autobiography, so it's possible to look at the work and see what was going on in her life and to read the work as this narrative of her life. So that's what I do. I show about 45 slides chronologically and talk about how these reflect her life, both her private life and her aesthetic life as an artist.
When you say that, illustrating her autobiography, it strikes me that I've never seen an O'Keeffe that has a person in it. Is that right? Did she ever paint a human being?
She did, very rarely. There's an early set of watercolors that she did in Texas of a friend of hers, and there's there are a couple of drawings of people, but no, you're right. She rarely did other humans. She rarely did living creatures. But that being said, she invests the images that she creates with so much emotion that it's very clear that she is delivering a personal message through the work. So that's what I am talking about. So I'll show an image and say this is what was going on in her life, and you can see from the image exactly how that's reflected there.
It was interesting for me when you said a moment ago that her work has so much emotion in it, those close-up flower pictures, for example, whereas the Paul Strand work was stripped of emotion. Is that a subjective judgment? I mean, how do you say that?
Well, when you look at the Paul Strand work, for example, it's a picture of white bowls, and they're sort of cupped against each other, and it's a very close-up picture, and you just see the rims and the shadows. It's a very abstract image, and it's black and white. And when you compare that to the famous image of the red poppy, for example, or the black iris, which show such sensitive, first of all, the textures themselves are very soft and fragile and vulnerable, and we all know that about flowers. We don't have to touch the canvas to know. We all have a very clear sense of what a flower is like, and the tissue itself is very fragile. Flowers have no way of protecting themselves. So we have this understanding that this is fragile material, very soft and vulnerable and tender, and the colors she uses are so powerful and so emotionally dramatic. And she said that herself once. She says, I go for the showy colors. That's what I like. So she deliberately chooses colors that have will create emotional responses in the viewer. She uses textures and the feeling of living tissue and membrane, things that make you have an emotional response. The way the red hills do, the soft red hills, which are, again, look tender and voluptuous and fluid. There's just a very powerful emotional drive that goes into her work, and I'll talk about it at length at the talk. But first of all, yes, everything is subjective. I mean, you can't write about art without being subjective. But I do think that between these very severe, austere, limited, formal images, black and white, that Paul Strand did, and the lush, tender, voluptuous, intimate pictures that O'Keeffe did, there's a huge emotional difference.
Roxana Robinson is the author of 8 books, including the biography Georgia O'Keeffe, A Life. And this Thursday at 6 o'clock, November 15th, she'll be giving a lecture titled O'Keeffe, Reading the Work as the Life. It's at the St. Francis Auditorium at the New Mexico Museum of Art. And it's part of the Georgia O'Keeffe 125th birthday celebration. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for having me.
And the website is RoxannaRobinson.com.